Today is Monday, September 21st, and this is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, tributes to the trailblazing U.S. lawyer and judge, Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Justice Ginsburg was a critical figure in the development of the law of gender equality.
Also ahead, spikes in COVID-19 cases may prompt new lockdowns. Plus, a new champion in the Tour de France bicycle race. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is COVID-19. Nearly 10 months since the disease first appeared in China, many countries are seeing resurgences of the virus. Russia reported over 6,100 new cases, the most recorded over 24 hours since mid-July. A surge in cases in the Czech Republic forced the health minister to resign following criticism of his handling of the outbreak. Cases are also spiking in the United Kingdom. With nearly 42,000 dead, Britain has the biggest COVID-19 death toll in Europe and the fifth largest in the world. World Health Organization statistics show the UK averaging over 3,000 new cases per day. Reuters reports that hospital admissions are doubling every 8 days and the testing system is buckling. On Monday, Britain's chief medical officer, Chris Whitty, said rates are going in the, quote, wrong direction, end quote, with figures suggesting there will be exponential growth of the disease unless action is taken. That was after UK Health Minister Matt Hancock said Sunday that the country's outbreak is at a, quote, tipping point, end quote. Emma McCarthy of Reuters has the story.
The UK's health minister has issued a stark warning that the country is at a tipping point when it comes to COVID-19. COVID-19 cases have risen sharply in recent weeks to more than 4,000 per day. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called it a second wave, and stricter lockdown measures have been introduced in areas across the country, with London possibly next in line. Matt Hancock told the BBC that a second national lockdown is a possibility.
If everybody follows the rules, then we can avoid further national lockdowns, but we of course have to be prepared to take action if that's what's necessary.
So we might be facing a further national lockdown if people don't obey the rules.
That's exactly right. I don't rule it out. I don't want to see it.
Opposition leader Keir Starmer said he would support whatever measures the government brings forward, but criticised the government's testing system for not having the capacity to deal with increased demand as schools returned.
That was Emma McCarthy of Reuters. The world's biggest outbreak is here in the United States. The U.S. coronavirus death toll is on track to hit 200,000 this week. As Americans mourn the dead, some who lost loved ones are urging others to take the disease seriously. One of them is Lisa Terrio Heath. She lost both her parents to COVID-19 and spoke to Freddie Joyner of Reuters, who has this story.
They died 5 days apart. My mom and my dad. I never told my mother when he died. I really was hoping that she could beat it, you know, and she didn't.
Lisa Terrio Heath lost both her parents to the coronavirus just days apart. Together for 65 years, Anthony and Rosemary Terrio met and got married in New York City, raised 4 children, and had 4 grandchildren. Anthony died from COVID-19 on March 31st. 2 weeks after being admitted to the hospital. As the family came together, Rosemary was also diagnosed with the disease, which quickly spread through the Terrio family.
And at that point, 8 family members had it. You know, it went the whole gamut. My sister was taking care of my mother. She caught it. Then she gave it to her son, and her son gave it to his partner, and my brother gave it to his wife, and my other brother caught it and gave it to his wife.
Rosemary died on April 5th, 5 days after her husband. Anthony Terrio was 86 years old. Rosemary was 82. The Terrios are just 2 of the nearly 200,000 who have died from COVID-19 in the United States. According to a forecast from the University of Washington's Health Institute, U.S. deaths could more than double by year's end, reaching 410,000. As Lisa Terrio-Heath continues to grieve the loss of her parents, she also feels anger at the politicians who downplayed the pandemic.
My mind is getting angry with all the things that could have been done. You know, I'm not usually political, but I really feel that Trump, my parents' generation was a generation that trusted their doctors, they trusted their leaders.
Lisa's other family members have since recovered from COVID-19, and they are donating blood plasma in an effort to help doctors find a cure to this devastating disease. While researchers continue to work towards a vaccine, Lisa appealed to people who still refuse to wear a face covering in public.
You know, my message to people is, you know, this pain will never go away for me. To put a mask on so that you never have to suffer what I went through or know that you possibly contributed to that is don't be selfish.
Reuters' Freddie Joyner filed that story. This is VOA. The mysterious deaths of hundreds of elephants in Botswana this year baffled and alarmed conservationists. But officials on Monday announced they think they found the culprit, toxins in water produced by cyanobacteria. Cyril Tallo, deputy director of the Department of Wildlife and National Parks, told a news conference that the number of dead elephants had risen to 330, Reuters reports. The Wildlife Department's principal veterinary officer, Madi Rubin, said there were still many unanswered questions about the deaths. Africa's overall elephant population is declining due to poaching, but Botswana, home to almost a third of the continent's elephants, has seen numbers grow to around 130,000 animals. The Emmy Awards took place last night, but this year, host Jimmy Kimmel dubbed the year's biggest TV award show as the Pandemmies. TV stars, usually decked out on the red carpet in high fashion, this year attended virtually from their couches and backyards, wearing a variety of gowns, hoodie sweatshirts, and pajamas. The family saga Succession, drama Watchmen, and feel-good comedy Schitt's Creek dominated the awards. Watchmen star Regina King, who won the Emmy for Best Lead Actress, used her acceptance speech to demand justice for Breonna Taylor, a black woman killed by police officers in the U.S. state of Kentucky this year. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. European Union foreign ministers met in Brussels Monday to discuss imposing sanctions against Belarus, which has been gripped in crisis since a disputed election in August. Long-standing President Alexander Lukashenko claimed victory, but the opposition said the vote was rigged. Since then, security forces have cracked down on dissidents as hundreds of thousands have taken to the streets demanding Lukashenko step down. Before Monday's meeting in Brussels, Lithuanian Foreign Minister Linas Linkevičius called on the EU to take action. Lithuania is hosting several exiled opposition leaders who fled Lukashenko's crackdown.
Now it's time to come up with some more tangible, clear action, and at least we can do definitely to issue sanctions. I hope our colleagues in European Union will not keep European Union in limbo and will not take hostage, basically, because it's really time to act.
German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas said the situation in Belarus is not getting better. The violence Lukashenko uses against peaceful protesters is totally unacceptable, end quote. He said the EU should consider sanctions on those involved in electoral fraud and violence, including Lukashenko. But any sanctions may be held up because Cyprus says it will not agree on penalizing Belarus unless the EU also puts sanctions on its neighbor, Turkey. Turkey, Cyprus, and Greece are involved in an unrelated dispute over Turkey's drilling of natural gas in the eastern Mediterranean. Cyprus claims the drilling area for itself. The dispute has raised tensions in the region with fears of clashes.
Our reaction to any kind of violation of our core basic values and principle cannot be a la carte. It needs to be
Cypriot
consistent.
Foreign Minister Nikos Christodoulidis said he didn't believe there was a deadlock over Belarus, but urged the EU to apply its values consistently. Longtime Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was the second woman to serve on the highest U.S. court, died Friday from complications of cancer. Ginsburg, a liberal and champion of women's rights, died at her home in Washington, surrounded by her family, according to a statement from the court. She was 87. Over the weekends, people around the U.S. set up vigils in Ginsburg's honor, including on the steps of the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. At the vigil, two mourners, both female lawyers, told me what Ginsburg meant to them.
I mean, RBG has been one of our heroes since law school, where we met in 2004. She paved the way for all of us.
Absolutely, and we also are graduates of all women's colleges, and both of us, and just in terms of our untiring fight for equality for women, that continues till this day. It is so important to be here tonight to honor her fight and to make a commitment to continuing that fight.
I litigate cases that really seem like on their face they shouldn't be able to be won based on the precedent. And it's people like RBG who have set the example of going for it no matter what, of doing the right thing and not stopping until you win, until justice is achieved.
And I think also finding myself in spaces that are often male dominated, some days when it's frustrating and some days it still remains frustrating, you think of her and you realize that you have to continue to carve out, even if it's morsel by morsel, that you have to carve out these spaces of understanding, that that is how we come to equality. It's not going to happen overnight, but that's really it. It's the inspiration to continue to fight that battle in those rooms day by day.
For a broader perspective on Justice Ginsburg's life and legacy, International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to Joel Richard Paul, a constitutional law professor at the University of California Hastings College of Law.
Justice Ginsburg was a critical figure in the development of the law of gender equality. She, as a young attorney, started taking on a number of cases that went up to the Supreme Court that really challenged assumptions that the law made about the roles that were appropriate for men and women. And really the seminal cases, the foundational cases that really kind of established the principle of gender equality were all cases that she actually argued before the Supreme Court. So when you think about her legacy, it's important to think about it not just in terms of the enormous contributions she made as a member of the Supreme Court, but also in terms of the enormous contributions she made, probably even greater contributions she made as an attorney, which really reshaped American law.
What about her time on the court itself?
Well, the first woman appointed to the court was Sandra Day O'Connor by President Reagan. That was his first court appointment. She was not appointed until President Clinton. So, I mean, for a long period of time, we only had one member of the court. Justice Ginsburg liked to say that gender equality would not be fully achieved until there were nine women on the Supreme Court. And since she's joined the court, two other women have joined the court. And I think that the significance of her role on the court was that she was a more centrist or more liberal member of the court than Justice O'Connor. And I think she kind of brought Justice O'Connor along and some other members of the court along on a number of important cases, not just cases involving gender equality. She tended to be someone who worked towards the middle. She was a consensus builder. She's was admired by people on both the right and the left of the court and more nationally by judges as a kind of judge's judge. I mean, she's a very solid technician. She was very cautious in the way that she wrote opinions. Her opinions don't have the kinds of pyrotechnics that Justice Scalia's opinions have, where he's always often sarcastic in his opinions. He was sometimes chastising his colleagues on the court. Her opinions are always more technical. There's less great quotes from her opinions. But from a lawyer's point of view, from just in terms of the technique, she's a much better lawyer and a much better judge. And people admired her for that.
That was Joel Richard Paul, a constitutional law professor at the University of California, Hastings. Multi-million dollar fines are part of sweeping new changes to heritage laws to protect ancient Aboriginal sites in Western Australia. The changes follow the destruction by mining giant Rio Tinto earlier this year of two sacred rock shelters dating back 46,000 years, despite opposition from Indigenous groups. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The draft legislation in Western Australia is called the Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Bill 2020. It would replace outdated 50-year-old legislation and removes a contentious section that allowed the government to give irreversible consent to land users to destroy culturally significant sites. Traditional Indigenous groups are to be given a greater say in the protection of their land under the proposed measure. In the past, some have agreed to sacrifice sacred sites to help impoverished First Nation communities receive a share in mining revenue. In May, Rio Tinto, the world's biggest iron ore miner, destroyed two ancient rock shelters at Juukan Gorge in Western Australia's Pilbara region as part of a new development. The Aboriginal caves were considered one of Australia's most significant archaeological research areas. Indigenous leaders had strongly opposed development at the site. The outcry, including anger among company shareholders, was so intense that Rio Tinto chief executive Jean-Sébastien Jacques and two senior executives were forced to quit. The new legislation was being drafted before the Juukan Gorge was damaged, and it promises a modern approach to protecting Aboriginal cultural heritage. Western Australian Minister for Aboriginal Affairs Ben Wyatt says resources companies like BHP have already responded positively.
What's already happened as a result of the Juukan caves is that miners with significant locations have effectively ceased work, and you've seen BHP in particular announce that. So those sites of extreme significance are already being reconsidered by the miners or the land users and the traditional owner groups. We've also released our new proposed legislation.
Should the legislation be approved by the Western Australian State Parliament, fines of up to $7.2 million could be imposed for unauthorised damage to Aboriginal sites. But Robin Chappell, a Greens lawmaker, said the bill proposed a new and complex system that under-resourced Indigenous groups would struggle to properly review before an October 9 deadline for public submissions. The Kimberley Land Council, one of Western Australia's biggest Indigenous organisations, said the proposed law completely disregards Aboriginal people and their right to care for their heritage. Tribal elders have demanded more legal protection for Aboriginal traditional owners, including the right to veto developments on their land. Public hearings continue Monday in a federal government inquiry in Canberra into the destruction of the Juukan Gorge caves. It's examining the failures by both government and businesses that allowed the site to be blown up to allow miners to dig out high-grade iron ore. The earth lies at the heart of Australia's ancient Indigenous culture, thought to be some 65,000 years old. Land is considered the mother of creation, connecting Aboriginal peoples to their past, present, and future. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Tadej Pogačar of Slovenia became the Tour de France's youngest winner in a century Sunday. The race was marred by the coronavirus pandemic, injuries, and criticism of the Tour's environmental impact. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
Slovenia's Tadej Pogačar from Team UAE Emirates coasted to fame in the French capital as riders made final laps around the Champs-Élysées before a sizably downsized mask-wearing crowd. Coronavirus restrictions limited fan numbers to just 5,000.
Monsieur Pogačar.
Tadej Pogačar qui s'offre pour...
On peut dire monsieur, je crois.
Pogačar, who celebrates his 22nd birthday Monday, becomes Slovenia's first tour winner. Besides the yellow jersey of the winner, he also snagged the tour's white and polka dot jerseys for best young rider and best mountain rider, respectively. Ireland's Sam Bennett won the green jersey for the points classification. Pogačar's win was cemented Saturday in a spectacular turnaround that saw countryman and former frontrunner Primoz Roglic perform poorly during a final climb. Pogačar echoed the shock victory.
I think I'm dreaming. That's all. I really don't know what to say.
The surprise turnaround added to a roller coaster tour that almost didn't happen. Normally taking place in July, the race was postponed because of coronavirus until late August. Rebounding coronavirus cases here sparked fears it would end early.
C'est Romain.
France's own hopes for a win were dashed, especially with the fall of hopeful Romain Bardet of team AG2R La Mondiale.
Non, le Covid nous a bien occupé, mais ça a été, comment dire...
AG2R team doctor Eric Bouvat said besides handling rider injuries, respecting coronavirus regulations proved tricky but manageable. Worries the smaller crowds would make riders less motivated to perform did not pan out.
On reverra le Tour de France à Lyon avec voilà une exigence.
There was other drama. Lyon's Greens Party mayor Eric Doucet criticized the tour as polluting and overly macho.
100 mètres, le coup d'envoi de cette 14e étape du Tour de France.
But that didn't stop the mayor from awarding the sprint winner's jersey to Ireland's Bennett during the Lyon stage of the tour, which was appropriately colored green. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Beginning in 2013, China has significantly increased its drive to put a stamp of ownership onto most of the numerous uninhabited islands, shoals, and submerged features in the South China Sea. Beijing has pursued environmentally destructive land reclamation and militarization of disputed outposts. This has done irreparable damage to coral reefs, said a high-level State Department official during a telephone press conference in late August. China has used these artificial platforms to expand the reach of its maritime militia and civilian law enforcement vessels, often backed by the Chinese military, to intimidate and bully Southeast Asian claimants to most of the waters in the South China Sea. This, despite the fact that in 2016, an arbitral tribunal constituted under Annex 7 of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea ruled that there was no legal basis for China to assert maritime claims beyond those specifically provided for in the convention. The United States aligned itself strongly with this decision, said the State Department official. We are deeply concerned over the increasingly brazen manner in which Beijing has deployed coercive tactics to inhibit other claimants' access to offshore marine resources. One thing is clear, Beijing's state-owned enterprises have played a key role in building and militarizing these outposts. For that reason, the U.S. State Department is imposing visa restrictions on Chinese nationals who are deeply involved in Beijing's destabilizing efforts in the South China Sea. At the same time, the U.S. Commerce Department has added 24 of Beijing's state-owned enterprises to its entity list for their role in these activities. This means that any item that is to be exported, re-exported, or even transferred within the country to a party on the entity list will need a specific license. Other countries can consider similar measures, and we think that that would be appropriate. The kind of concerns that we have about the South China Sea and other PRC malign activity are very widely shared and increasingly widely shared. And we know that other countries obviously are looking at scrutinizing their policies with respect to their diverse relationships with China in terms of business, academic exchange, visa, and much else, said the State Department official. We are taking actions to make clear that further militarization and further coercion is unacceptable and entirely contrary to the interests of China's neighbors and the United States and the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.